A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Does it feel like Scott Morrison settling in for two terms?
I think that anybody who calls the next election now is a mug. I saw people who were predicting with great degree of certainty that we were going to win the last election, the day before the election, predicting with a great degree of certainty that we're going to lose the next one. You know, well, you know, none of us have the crystal ball.
Well, hello, good people of pods. You've survived the penultimate sitting week for 2019, and so have we. It's Catherine Murphy. You're with Australian Politics Live, and in the pod cave today,
here we are.
He's looking nervous. Don't know why. Is Chris Bowen, who I still think of as the Shadow Treasurer, but is
not
the Shadow Treasurer anymore.
Enjoying being Shadow Minister for Health.
Well, you're quite busy in health.
I am. It's the portfolio I asked for after the election. It's very important to people's lives. It's very important to Labor's agenda, legacy and agenda, you know, building on Medicare.
Yeah.
It's very important to social justice. The social determinants of health are pretty strong in Australia. Your wealth and your postcode determine your health, and that offends me. I've met in my 6 months in the portfolio a huge array of really interesting people doing really interesting things, from medical research institutes to Indigenous Aboriginal medical services in really remote Australia, you know, right up and down across the board. And to be very honest with you, to be very, very frank, I'd done 10 years of, when I thought about it, 10 years of pretty tough jobs. In effect, 10 years as either immigration minister, treasurer, or shadow treasurer. I'm not saying health's not a tough job, but it's busy and hard and all that sort of stuff. But 10 years of jobs which have a degree of controversy attached to them in immigration and then treasury, and, you know, hard decisions and being the guy in the suit up the front talking about numbers and all that sort of stuff.
And, oh, you carry a big load. Well, the second biggest load, well, forgive politicians who are listening, will have a different view, but the second biggest load after the Prime Minister.
I think most people would recognise that, you know, the treasury portfolio in opposition or government is really, you know, up there in the top sort of two or three in terms of controversy and workload and all that sort of stuff. And I thought, well, maybe it's time to do a job where, you know, I'm dealing with real people about real issues and frankly, a more natural Labor job as opposed to immigration in particular and in Treasury.
Well, let's, as we're on the olden times, just briefly, let's stick with the olden times. It sort of feels like centuries ago, really.
6 months, really.
I know. It's amazing.
The next election is probably now 2 years away. Think about that for a second.
Oh, God. Yes. Anyway, so just I'll start with a simple question. Did you think you were going to lose the election?
No. No, look, I would say we weren't arrogant, we weren't hubristic. I know some people will put that claim. I reject that completely. Bill Shorten, Tanya, all of us, I would reject that. I think we were talking every day and we were on high alert, you know. There was no point where the leadership group or the senior team were putting their feet up going, we're home. That was just that juncture did not happen. We were having 6 a.m. phone calls every day, batting away issues, identifying challenges, you know, all that stuff. But all the objective evidence was that we were on track to win. The Libs thought they were going to lose. Don't let one of them tell you otherwise, you know. The Lib staffers were looking for jobs. The Lib ministers were planning post-politics careers, and not unreasonably, you know. We'd been ahead in the opinion polls for, you know, three years solidly, longer really, you know, patchily, but 3 years solidly. We had successfully removed two prime ministers and two treasurers. We're on our third cycle. You know, Bill and I had faced, Bill had faced three prime ministers, I'd faced three treasurers. We'd won, you know, all the by-elections that we could reasonably expected to win, and that they'd lost, you know, Wentworth, and they thought they'd win Mayo, and they lost it, and all that stuff.
Yep.
So I thought, I think it was a reasonable analysis and expectation, which I think, you know, a day hasn't gone by since when I haven't been stopped in the street by, you know, a punter saying, I thought you were going to win, and I'm very disappointed you didn't. I mean, that's what most people thought.
Mm.
And so it did come as a, I wouldn't say a shock, because you never really know.
Yeah.
But, and, you know, as I said, we were never complacent about it, but, you know, to be honest, yes, yeah, it's just, we thought we were going to win, and I think most reasonable people did.
Thought the same. Mm. So why didn't you?
Well, you know, Catherine, it seems to me that there's a bit of a cycle, a bit of a pattern here. We should basically put in our diary two things, you know, election day and day after election day, surprise why the left-wing party didn't win, you know, Hillary Clinton, you know, Brexit in a different context, right across, you know, and why the populists are the right. And what we're seeing is the traditional blue-collar working class base of Labor or our equivalents around the world fraying, finding the message of populist right-wingers to some degree attractive.
Yeah.
And under our system, you know, under other systems that might mean that the vote frays, but under our system it flows straight back to the Liberals and Nationals through preferences. And we saw that. I mean, our vote fell, so did the Liberals, and Pauline Hanson's and Clive Palmer's rose, and then it swings right back to them. And and in marginal or safe Liberal seats, people of, you know, high wealth and, you know, comfortable means swung to us, but we had swings away from us in more traditional Labor areas. Now, there is no one reason why that's the case, and, you know, the review that we've just went through found that, you know, it identified a few issues. But if you removed, you could, and, you know, obviously I've thought a lot about this since, if you removed any one of those issues, you could say, well, they would have won, you know, but with all of them, it was too much.
Too much. What about, because obviously, what about the revenue measures specifically? Like, I want to talk about that.
Sure.
I want to talk about that period. So what you were responsible for those. Yes. We'll unpack that shortly, but you were responsible for those. What role did they play in Labor's election defeat?
I agree with the review. The Emerson Wetherill Review, which found that, I think the line in there, I don't want to misquote them, but from memory the line is, Labor's tax policies did not cost the election, you know, and the people who swung to us were affected by our tax policies. You know, the conventional wisdom was we were taking money off people and they wouldn't vote for us. That's not what happened. But I also agree, and this is very important with the review, that the size of our agenda scared people, for want of a better word, and the general Labor tax and spend message got up, you know. So it wasn't one particular measure.
Yeah.
It was the general Liberal scare campaign on tax. You know, despite the fact our tax to GDP ratio rise was pretty modest, despite the fact that the policies that Bill and I and the team put together look pretty modest compared to what most of the Democratic candidates in the US primary are nominating, you know, we look like wusses.
Well, it's a much more centrist agenda than Elizabeth Warren,
absolutely,
for example, or Bernie Sanders or Jeremy Corbyn.
Yes, most of the candidates, all British Labor, yes. It was seen as radical in the Australian context, but in the international context it was very modest, really. But, no, I think the review got that part of it pretty right to say. Now, of course, when you are raising money to spend on health and education and infrastructure and other things, you've got a choice. You can either hit everybody, like, you know, you've got to remember through the context of, particularly over the 6 years, we spent a considerable part of the first half of those 6 years arguing against people who said we should increase the GST. You know, there were people in the Labor Party even saying the GST should go up. Now, if we'd increased the GST as our policy, it wouldn't have been a close election, in my view. would have been a landslide against us.
Against you.
Against us. Because you're hitting ordinary people.
Yeah.
You know, it's a regressive tax. So then, or you can say, well, let's close down some loopholes, reform some loopholes, loopholes which are in, you know, which are regressive, no longer fit for purpose, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah. With franking credits, for example, and we'll get into the revenue measures in just a sec, but with franking credits, now obviously, you know, you're not the leader, it's not your job to announce what the policy may or may not be, but do you think regardless of where Labor goes on that, and anecdotally MPs say it was franking credits was bad for them, difficult for them.
Well, it was certainly the most controversial, loudest of the measures,
exactly,
yes.
Exactly, right. But at the end of the day, the impact of that on the budget is unsustainable.
Yeah, look, I don't want to get in the way of Albo and Jim and the work they're doing to, you know, prepare, and there'll be a shadow cabinet conversation about all those things in due course. But, you know, we identified areas which we thought were unsustainable going forward.
And it's still unsustainable, well, isn't, you know, it? Facts don't change just because Labor loses
election. It remains a lot of money. It remains a lot of money, absolutely. You know, roughly what we spend on public schools is the equivalent of what goes on franking credit. So it remains a lot of money. Now, as I said, I think Albo has made the right call to say all policies are effectively not policies anymore,
yeah,
and then we'll work out which ones come back. Yeah, and then we had a lot of different revenue-raising policies, some of which weren't controversial at all, really. I mean, remember, like, say, family trust reform, for example, which was a big one that I did.
Yeah, a lot of dollars.
We thought a lot about it, you know. It's been in the too hard basket for 40 years, basically. Several Liberal treasurers thought about doing it and got their knees cut off and couldn't proceed. In the end, it was going to raise about $7 billion. I mean, really.
Not a peep.
I mean, I would say probably didn't lose a vote over it, really. Franking credits was a lot louder and more controversial, more people impacted. There is no rush for us to make calls on these things, you know, as Albo has said. Obviously, if you raise less revenue, you'll spend less. Yeah. Jim's made that point, and he's right about that.
Well, yeah. Now, I want to drill into this slightly, right? Because you and I spoke a lot, really, over the last parliamentary term, you know, on this show and elsewhere, just about Labor's thinking on and economic repositioning. And, you know, and that was that, you know, that's a big, complicated debate, fascinating debate, really. At the end of the day, you, you know, given the sort of, given your values and your mentors in politics, you were a slightly odd front man for a big taxing agenda.
Well,
hang on. You'll have plenty of chances to say you're an idiot. You're an idiot. That's fine.
I won't call you an idiot or a doofus
Thank you. Don't mention the war. You were a slightly odd front man, right? So did you have to chase revenue measures in order to pay for spending that was not adequately restrained in the last term of Parliament? Because that's what it looks like.
So, okay, yeah, that's a fair question. You took a while to ask it, so let me take a little while to answer it. You call me a fairly odd front man because I'm generally, you know, I'm off the right of the party, I think is what you're implying.
Yeah,
it's true.
I just should say that, yeah, because you're in the right and Keating is your mentor.
Yes,
right?
And Paul Keating is correctly seen as my, you know, mentor is not a term I particularly use, but sure, I'll accept it. You know, we talk a lot and, you know, he's also a hero and all that sort of stuff. I've made the point several times, including in the recent inaugural Paul Keating lecture I made, but I'd made it previously. People forget what the Keating agenda is, you know, in my view. All these years later, it sort of gets rewritten in history. He was closing down tax loopholes and reforming tax loopholes. Sure, he was reducing tax rates, but we were too. I mean, we had bigger tax cuts on the table for most of that six-year term. You know, capital gains tax was his. Fringe benefits tax was his. Hugely controversial at the time. The Liberals went to the 1987 election promising to reverse them. So, you know, I won't accept that Keatingism and sort of that political tradition is some sort of pallid version of liberalism.
Aggressive. Totally fair.
You know, I think what I was doing and what we were doing was in keeping with that agenda. I was talking to Paul all through that process and, you know, running ideas past him.
His own views evolved as well, right?
Yes.
Keating's own views.
Absolutely.
But the general point right?
Yes.
Spending was...
Yes. No, I'm getting... get to your point, yes. We had, again, we had a big-ish spending agenda, all of which was justified on its merits, health, education in particular. You could quibble about some of the other ones, in less sort of high-profile areas as to whether they were political benefits for doing it. And I think, yes, going forward, if I could put it that way, we've got to make sure that our spending is under control is rigorously applied, and that a big agenda is not necessarily always in every element a big spending agenda. Mm. I mean, there are other things you can do as a political party. There's processes you can put in place. There's policies you can change. There's rigorous testing you can apply, which is progressive and big in agenda, but which is not big spending. And I think we've always got to be thinking about, well, is spending the first option or the last option, or is there other ways we can be progressing the agenda? In some elements, it'll be spending, but doesn't always have to be. And I think that we need to supply every bit of support to that, to our leadership team, to provide that big spending agenda. And so, for example, in my health portfolio, yes, of course.
It's funny with now the boots on the other foot.
I've joked a bit about that with colleagues. Well, I'll be coming to the table asking for. Well, exactly. Dr. No,
exactly.
And now, and I would say, in fairness, without going into details, I don't want to go into internal discussions, but most of our colleagues would have argued that Jim and I, as the sort of economics team, were pretty tough on them. A lot of spending got rejected.
Mm.
You saw what got approved. You didn't see all the times we were saying no. Which is how it should be. There's a process, right? You can argue maybe we should have said no more often, or maybe we should have won the argument more often. I'm not going to go through internal discussions, but you can make that case. But the point I'm making to you is I wouldn't want to leave you or your listeners with the impression that, we were just Mr. Yes to all spending. We were not. There were shadow ministers doing really good work, coming up with really good ideas, really well crafted, and they'd come to us and we say, no, we can't afford that, on a daily basis. Again, that's our job. It'll be Jim and Katie's job now.
Good luck to them. Good luck to them.
But, I guess what we're coming back to is the opening point that I made, that I agree with the review. The review said, basically spending set the agenda, tax had to pay for it.
Mm.
And either you tax everybody through something like an increase in the GST, or you do the sorts of things we did.
But did you? I'll just ask that. We're going to get onto the future in a sec, but I'll just ask: did it give you the shits? I mean, in the sense that there was a dynamic immediately. While everyone was waiting for the review.
Yes.
Right. What will the review say? Will the review be terrible to Bill?
Yes.
Who will the review finger most? Will Bowen be the bad guy? Will Mark Butler be the bad guy? Who will be the villain of the piece, right? What you're telling me in this conversation is the last term in Parliament was the sum of its parts, right?
Sure.
Did it frustrate you, that period of wondering whether or not you were going to be Colonel Mustard with the candlestick in the library?
Not particularly that element. Again, to be frank with you, there isn't a day that's gone by since the election where I haven't gone through a period of, introspection as to what did we do, what did I do, could I have done things differently, better? And of course, the inevitable answer to that for all of us is yes, because we came second in the election, me no less than anybody else. Was I particularly worried about the review or blame game and all that sort of stuff? No, not really, because at the end of the day, people will make their own judgments. I know what I think. I know I did my best. I know the team did our best. We couldn't have worked harder. We have to reflect on where we fell short, and we did fall short. And we have to, most importantly, learn the lessons going forward. I think in the immediate aftermath of the election, it was very easy and understandable. People say, it must have been the tax policies. Mm-hmm. Must have been, clearly, obviously, the tax policies. I think it was a whole lot more complex and nuanced than that. I'm not saying our tax policies didn't play a role, but I think, the review correctly says, well, the people actually impacted by the policies voted for us or swung to us. A whole heap of other issues, Christianity and religious freedom played a role, which I've pointed out as well. Yeah. And, you know, that was a bigger issue in some places than others.
Yeah.
Bigger issue in Western Sydney and Queensland than it would have been in Victoria or elsewhere. You know, just a few random examples. I mean, obviously, there are different issues at play in Queensland. You know, if the election was decided between Baha'i, New South Wales, Victoria, South Australia, Northern Territory, Tasmania and the ACT, we'd have a government. Nice, comfortable majority.
Yeah.
Queensland and Western Australia coming in means we lost.
Yeah.
So if our policies and our agenda got us a majority in most of the states or, you know, in those states and territories minus Queensland and Western Australia, we got something right. We clearly got other things wrong. And there was obviously, very particularly in Queensland, a whole bunch of issues and, you know, of course Adani is one of them, which played particularly badly for us. That's just a statement of fact. You know, so all of us, I think, have gone through, and me included, a period of thinking we've let people down, we've let our supporters down by losing, you know, because people were relying on us to be a better government than this rotten, awful, god-awful, terrible bunch of jokers that we've got now. You know, we're going to have to put up with for the next 2 years. But above it all is a sense of determination to be part of the winning team next time. And that's the overriding, you know, emotion that I have, determination to keep going and to win the next election and to be a good government. And, again, I don't want to get into, you know, which policy or that, but the answer is not no policies.
Mm.
The answer is not a small agenda.
Mm.
I mean, we lost two elections last year, or you know, this year, New South Wales and federal.
The federal, yeah.
New South Wales with a, you know, I'm not being critical, but New South Wales with a small policy agenda, we lost quite badly. You know, they didn't have big controversial policies out there, and they lost. And we had big controversial policies and lost. You know, we lost in 98 with basically no policies. We lost in 01. With no policies, you know. Again, I mean, I'm using shorthand, but not with the big controversial policies.
Yeah.
A small target agenda does not
Equal victory.
Equal victory. Equal it does victory. Not. And where would we be if we said, "Oh, well, let's just roll in small ball, and do nothing, and we lose next time"? You know, you know, thinking we'll surf to victory on the back of their incompetence,
on the giant nothingness, and the government's incompetence.
So here I say. The answer is not a small agenda. The answer is an agenda which better connects and a political narrative. And I don't think in hindsight we brought the narrative of what we were doing together well enough, clearly. About this is what we're doing and why we're doing it. And here's the broader picture for our country and our society. And I spent a lot of time batting away arguments about, well, you're not affected and you're not affected and you are affected and here's why, but not as much as you think, et cetera, et cetera. And, I spent hours dealing with all that and, you know, I look back retrospectively and I think about what I got right and what wrong and I think and there's plenty of things where I think, oh, no, I could have done that better. But on those things, I think we did well, you know. But what we didn't do, obviously, is bring the argument together for voters who in some instances only tuned in at the last minute, you know, what we call low informational voters. They're busy people, running busy lives, worried much more about who's going to pick up the kids from soccer and get the dinner on the table than, you know,
what's going on in
Josh Frydenberg or Chris Bowen or Jim Chalmers said today, you know, and, you know, 2 days before the election start to think about it and then looked at it and clearly too many of those people just said, no, too risky. I think I don't like the current guys very much, but I think I'll stick with them.
Mm. Just religious freedom before we look forward. As you say, that seems to have been a particular issue in Western Sydney. Rubber's about to hit the road in the parliament on religious freedom, and there was an indicative position put to caucus this week about religious freedom, which was suggestive to my ear that Labor would be resistant to flowing the provisions that exist now in religious schools, for example, to aged care facilities and other things. What's your view?
Well, again, we've still got a process to go through and we don't yet know the final legislation.
Yeah.
You know, this has been a dog's breakfast on Christian Porter's behalf and we don't yet know exactly the form that will go to the parliament. But I'll say this, Catherine. I mean, I represent a very religious community. I mean, the socially conservative community. My electorate voted no on same-sex marriage. I voted yes, and I knew there would be a political price to pay for that because I wasn't representing the views of many of my constituents, but I was honest with them about that and upfront with them at the election before last and said I would be voting yes. So, you know, I wanted to do that to get a mandate so that they, you know, they couldn't say I changed my mind post-election or whatever. Yeah. But I knew it was going to be controversial. I've been talking to, you know, so I've got an electorate which is, I think I'm right in saying the most Catholic electorate in Australia, certainly in New South Wales, and also a very heavy representation of the Orthodox religions, Orthodox Christianity. I've got the biggest representation of that. So Christianity is, they're not just Christians. Mm. Christianity is very important to who they are.
Yes, yeah. It's part of their identity.
Yes, and they generally have voted for me as a progressive politician. But this bill is friendless. Friendless. I mean, they have cocked it up so badly that I've got my religious leaders saying, oh, well, we don't like it. We think it's a pretty ordinary piece of legislation. You know, and there's a whole bunch of people. I've also met with people on the other side. You know, I spend a lot of time with meeting with gay and lesbian representatives, and they don't like it. And, you know, I'll have my say internally, but it's a pretty friendless piece of legislation.
But what about that principle, though, that obviously schools are currently permitted to discriminate?
Yeah, but they don't, in fact. Like, no, they don't discriminate against students. I've seen no evidence. Even the most conservative, you know, small c, orthodox conservative religious leader in my electorate would say, if a student comes out as gay in our school, we embrace them and we don't expel them.
But for hiring,
yes,
for personnel. Oh, well,
yeah, different issues going. Yeah, and remember, this was a big issue in the Wentworth by-election and Scott Morrison promised to fix it.
Yes.
You know, and has done nothing.
Yes, but what is your own view? Should those discriminations apply or not?
Well, I think you've got to see that through the context of the broader religious freedom bill. It's not a religious freedom bill. That's what they promised. It's not what they're delivering.
Well, it's an anti-discrimination bill. Or a positive discrimination bill.
Well, it's not actually positive discrimination. I mean, they actually promised a religious freedom bill, and what they've done is a religious discrimination bill, but they've cocked it up in its delivery. Now, to be clear, we're all for religious freedom. I mean, I haven't really met anybody who doesn't advocate for freedom of religion. Mm. And then there's a complicated, you know, I mean, I've met with gay clergy, who have... you know, very considered views about these things. Mm. So, look, I think you can't just single out one issue and say, well, what do you think about that issue? You've got to see it in the terms of the context.
I've told you,
I think the legislation as it's drafted is pretty bloody ordinary.
But you've also told me that this is a political issue for Labor.
It's a huge issue, and we were alive to it in the campaign. I mean, I think back again, we had our 6 a.m. phone hookups every day. And I think, well, what were the incoming issues? What were we worried about? Mm. You know, and this was one of them. Perhaps it was more acute than we realised, but we were alive to it. We weren't complacent about it. You know, Israel Folau blew up big time, and I think we didn't realise how biting that would be.
Well, Bill Shorten just waded right into that. And
in fairness to Bill, I remember he was asked in one of those town halls, I think it was the Sky one, he was asked by clearly a person of religion about Israel Folau, and I thought his answer was fine. Mm. You know, I thought he gave a perfectly appropriate, sympathetic answer, and she was shaking her head at him. Mm. You know, he wasn't connecting on that issue, and that's not his fault, because I think I would have given exactly the same answer. Mm. Clearly that, in a way that wasn't on the front page of every newspaper in terms of its electoral context, was a big issue, but it's an electoral context. It worried people of faith that, you know, whether they agreed with Israel Folau or not, and of course he said, you know, more outrageous things since. But at the time, I mean, what he said was outrageous in and of itself, but you know, but there were plenty of people even who they didn't agree with. They said, well, you know, I've got some religious views too and I want the right to those. And I think it was a much bigger issue politically and electorally than anybody really realised.
Do you think it's slightly multidimensional in this sense, right, that there's people for whom religion is an identity issue, as you've identified, but there's also a sort of dynamic in the community where there are clearly some people think you've got to shut up. Right,
yes.
that things are all
there's
too PC.
Yes, that's right.
And you're not allowed to say things
correct.
Like, you know, well, stuff Israel Folau said, or...
Or stuff even not as...
I don't like gays, or whatever, right? That or, some thought police will...
Or in, from their point of view, reflect the what the Bible says.
Yes, not, right. So do you think that's part of it too? Because then that makes it even more complicated.
Yeah, and I think that means we have to acknowledge that if that is the perception, it is therefore the reality. You know, if somebody feels that, even if they can say that and not be discriminated against, if they feel they can't express their religious views, they feel persecuted or potentially persecuted for their religious views, that's a problem. Even if, as Bill said, I don't understand what you think you can't say, you know, as you said in that answer.
Exactly. Yeah.
But if the person says, well, I don't think I can reflect my views in polite conversation or, you know, then I think that's a problem for society and for those of us who care about freedom of expression.
But it's complex, isn't it? In your Keating lecture, I sort of read you engaging with the culture point, engaging with the culture wars point, and saying, well, we as progressives have just got to continue the process of well, education makes it sound patronising, not validating those views necessarily.
But taking it on.
Right. Whereas Claire O'Neill, and I'm not trying to set you up at odds, but Claire O'Neill was more, well, we've sort of, well, I mean, God, I was going to say got to cuddle those views, and that's not at all what she said.
No.
What she said was much more complex and interesting than that.
Yeah.
But...
And I don't think, I know you're not, I don't think what she and I said were contradictory, really.
No, but there's a nuance there, right?
Sure.
So...
Well, my point was... the conservatives and, you know, our critics in the media say, oh, Labor plays identity politics too much. That's bullshit. The Liberals play identity politics much more than we do and much more effectively. They play it much better. They divide Australians. I mean, Scott Morrison in particular is a divider. He divides Australians. You know, he gave a speech the other week. I almost drove off the road when I was listening to it on a podcast. He talked about the goat's cheese circle encircling inner city. I mean, this is the Prime Minister of all Australians.
Mm.
He's meant to be all of our, even those of us.
Who like goat's cheese.
I don't mind a bit of feta. Everything's better with feta. But I don't regard myself as an inner city lefty either. You know, I represent and live in the outer suburbs of Sydney. I grew up there, raising two kids there now, both going to public school. We don't sit around, you know.
With your pinky
in
out
Smithfield
eating.
Yeah. Eating avocado smash every day and with feta on top.
Mm.
But my point is, I'm going off on a tangent. My point is they're dividers. You know, he's dividing Australians in between, you know, people who like goat's cheese and apparently the real Australians in the regions who, you know, apparently don't like goat's cheese. I mean, bugger off, mate. Stop dividing us like that. That's identity politics. And they did it most effectively, I think, in the election campaign. And this was we were dealing with this on our 6 a.m. phone calls every day. And we did get this wrong in terms of the politics of it. They did it most effectively on electric cars, ironically enough.
Yeah.
You know, Mark Butler did great policy. It was a ripper of a policy. I endorsed it when it came to Shadow Cabinet. I thought he'd done really good work. Electric cars, who can argue? They're very expensive, so let's get the market up so the price comes down and people get more choice. And if you want an electric car, you can buy one. If you don't, you don't have to. But at the moment, they're out of reach for most people because they're so bloody expensive. Now, they then turn that into they're coming for your utes.
Mm. War on the weekend.
War on the weekend, war on the four-wheel drives, war on the utes, war on the tradies. That's identity politics played very effectively. You know, on a policy matter, which we were looking at through a economic prism, an environmental prism. And we thought to the degree it had political implications. We thought, well, young people, you know, like the idea of an electric car, can't afford it. That'll be pretty popular. Didn't see it being weaponized in suburbs and regions as, you know, they're going to come and take your forward territory. You know, that bad Bill Shorten, Chris Bowen, they're going to come and confiscate your
vehicle.
Kluger.
Yes.
And it worked for them. I mean, it was a big issue and a negative one for us. So that's identity politics. And that's what I'm saying about culture wars. It's not just about the obvious, you know, Israel Folau.
No.
You know.
No.
It's about them saying to people, in effect, they don't say this, but this is what we want you to vote against your economic interests because we're not very good to you, but we're on your side culturally.
Yeah. Well, that's the divide, isn't it?
Yes. That's the divide. So I say, all right, you want to fight about the culture wars? All right, here we go. Sleeves up. Let's get into it. Mm. You know, we're going to stand up for our values. And our values, what we have to do is constantly remind people, tell people, and remind ourselves it's our job. We're on your side. It sounds like a motherhood statement, but we haven't said it enough.
Mm.
You know, we are on the side of the tradie. We have better policies for middle-income people and tradies. And tradies want their kids to go to a good school. And they want to know that they're not going to be waiting for 12 hours at the emergency department if something goes wrong on a Sunday night and all that stuff. We have better policies than all of that. But obviously, we didn't do a good enough job in connecting that to their everyday lives. And they had the simple message about, well, they're going to come and take your Ford Territory and, you know, they're going to put your taxes up, even though most people weren't affected by our tax policies, all that sort of stuff.
Now, I mean, oh, God, time's against us. I was going to do much more.
I thought we were just getting going.
Well, we are. This is the problem. Time is against us, though. I was going to do much more on the future, but time doesn't allow.
I reckon people will listen to a three-hour podcast from you and me. I mean... Oh, there are some out there, you know.
Oh, no, Nick, there are, some people would. Some people would.
And,
and we love them. Thank you for tuning in. Thank you for subscribing. We love all of you.
We do too.
But I can feel the producer's anxiety. So let's do – we might have a conversation in due course about the future, which is more detailed than the one we're about to have.
Sure.
Let me say, okay, looking forward over the term, what do you want to achieve?
Well, I want to put together a good health policy. For the team, you know, the policies last time, which I was very proud of, funding, you know, Catherine King did the work, the policy work, but I was very proud of Shadow Treasurer to fund them, particularly, you know, what I think is the next frontier of Medicare, which is dental. You know, poor oral health leads to poor health, and there are too many people, and we targeted pensioners because that's where it's at its most acute, who lose their teeth because they can't afford to see the dentist. And the states are groaning under a long waiting list for their public schemes. So I'm not announcing a health policy today, but, you know, when I asked for the health portfolio, I thought, well, Neil blew it, you know, Medicare, the agenda, and there's still much more to do. And we talk about universal healthcare. I've stopped using the term universal healthcare.
Because no one knows what it means.
No, because it's not true.
Oh, I see, because it's there are large emissions.
Because there are millions of people who put off healthcare because they can't afford it.
Yeah.
Medicare is, I think, the best healthcare system in the world. It's a great labour achievement. It is not yet perfect. I want to make it more perfect. And I want to be a very important part of the alternative government, and I want to be a very important part of the next Labor government.
And does it feel like Scott Morrison's settling in for two terms?
I think that anybody who calls the next election now is a mug. I think that it's very easy. You know, I saw. I don't want to name names because they're not bad people, but I saw people who were predicting with great degree of certainty that we were going to win the last election, the day before the election, predicting with a great degree of certainty that we're going to lose the next one. You know, well, you know, none of us have the crystal ball. I do know this. I was elected in 2004. I was very happy to be here, but the party was pretty depressed. not about my arrival, about our defeat in 2004.
About
the Mark Latham election.
Afterwash.
Correct. Yes. And I remember, and you remember because you were here too.
I was.
John Howard was utterly dominant.
Hmm.
I remember in question time sitting there, I was a very, you know, junior backbencher, and John Howard was, of course, you know, hard of hearing. And so the house was raucous. And as Prime Minister, he would just put up his hand and everybody behind him would go quiet. He didn't have to say a word, didn't turn around. He just put up his hand. That was the degree of his dominance of the chamber. He was monstering us every day. And people were saying breathlessly, the next Prime Minister, next Labor Prime Minister is not yet in the Parliament. I think some said, the next Labor Prime Minister has not yet been born. I mean.
I do remember that, actually.
Yeah. And what happened? Within 3 years, he'd lost his seat. And we had a very significant majority on the floor of the House of Representatives. You know, that was not predicted at the beginning of that term. So I say we might win the next election, we might lose the next election. I do not know. I've got no idea. All I know is we have to give ourselves the best chance.
Well, good note to end on, Chris. Thank you for coming in. Thank you, as always, to Miles Martignoni, executive producer of this show, and to his team. Remember Full Story, Guardian Australia's other podcast. You can subscribe to that via your favourite podcast app or wherever you get your pods. If you are an intermittent listener to this series, don't forget, subscribe. Then you get every episode. Next week is the final parliamentary sitting week. Can you believe it?
Yeah, I wish it was this week. But anyway, so does Angus Taylor, just quietly.
Well, so does everyone. Oh, it's been a year. It has been a time. It has been a year. Anyway, final sitting week next week. We'll be back with you then.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.